On behalf of the clergy and staff, it's my joy and privilege to welcome you to our beautiful space here. And we say hello. Everyone say hi.
Hi.
We are live. It's our first time live streaming. So hello to everybody coming into us from the vast expanse of interstellar space. We welcome you here among us. So my name is Lee Kern, and I'm one of the priests here at St. James Cathedral. And we are so excited that you're all here with us tonight for this important lecture, and it couldn't be more timely, eh? So we put on Christian education series that are open to the public, free to all, and we start with worship at 6 and then a meal at 6:30 together, and then our lecture here at approximately 7. I'm sure people were waiting on the live stream down to the second, and they know I'm a little bit late, so I'm sorry about that. Now, about our talk here tonight. We are here to think, pray, and talk amongst each other and at our tables, and the conversation spills over into our lives about this crisis that we find ourselves in now with nuclear warfare and nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons, seemingly a bygone problem of the Cold War, have raged back into our daily headlines, from North Korea to Iran to the decay of U.S.-Russian relations. The threat of nuclear conflict feels more pressing than it has in decades. Fears are exacerbated by the heated rhetoric coming currently from the White House, where President Trump holds the unilateral power to destroy life on Earth with one single order. What is a Christian or a person in general to think, feel, and do in our anxious age? This talk here tonight with Reverend Tyler Wig Stevenson will supply a brief premiere on the history and current state of nuclear weapons, as well as an overview of Christian theological and political engagement with nuclear weapons, deterrence, and disarmament, and will conclude with the possible next steps for action and advocacy in the Canadian church context. Now, before we begin, I'd like us to take a moment of silence and a moment of prayer here together. God of peace, God who is our peacemaker, make peace in our hearts, peace between us and one another and all creation. In gratitude, God, we acknowledge this traditional land of your indigenous peoples here, the Huron-Wendat, the Haudenosaunee, the Mississaugas of New Credit. And we acknowledge the responsibility of this land and the responsibility to live as people of peace, truth, and reconciliation with all our relations here on this beautiful land in the shores of Niganigichigami, Lake Ontario. Show us the way of peace. Show to us the path of truth and life, and help us to walk there in it. In Jesus' name we pray. Thank you. Now it's my delight to introduce to you my friend and colleague, the Reverend Tyler Wig Stevenson. He is the assistant pastor just down the street, and I know some of you go there too, at Little Trinity Anglican Church, and he's the author of several books, including multiple award-winning The World Is Not Ours to Save. Prior to entering full-time congregational ministry, Tyler worked for many years as a faith-based advocate for the abolition of nuclear weapons, principally as the founder of the U.S.-based Two Futures Project. Tyler continues to serve as chair of the Global Task Force on Nuclear Weapons for the World Evangelical Alliance, an international network of 600 million Christians, and sits on the board of the Plowshares Fund, a leading nuclear security funding organization. Tyler has spoken about faith in nuclear weapons at venues as varied as the United Nations, Washington National Cathedral, and Willow Creek Church, as well as in numerous interviews with both secular and religious media. Currently a doctoral student in interdisciplinary theology at the University of Toronto, Tyler has written extensively on issues of faith and culture, both in peer-reviewed journals and popular publications like The Washington Post, Christianity Today, CNN.com, and Sojourners. Tyler and his wife, Natalie, a professor and theologian, live in Toronto with their two young daughters. And it's my joy to welcome here today.
Good evening. I want to extend my sincere thanks to the cathedral for having me this evening, for extending this invitation, in particular to Lee for giving me this invitation, and also wanted to thank my friend Tay, the Reverend Tay Moss, whose volunteer hard work is allowing this to be live streamed. His technical expertise is extraordinary, and I'm grateful for his generous gift of it. Tonight is personally exciting for me because, as you'll have gathered from the introduction, I spent much of my early career in professional anti-nuclear work. And this is the first time that I have ever been able or had the opportunity to bridge these two vocational halves of my life. The one, the anti-nuclear work, which I've been doing since I graduated from college and has occupied the better part of the last 18 years for me. And then this priestly and pastoral ministry, which for me started as a Baptist minister in 2006. I never wound up serving a church. I wound up in this faith-based advocacy role instead, and then finally wound up here in Toronto, where I have the great privilege of serving as a pastor to the people at Little Trinity Church. And so for me, this is exciting, the chance to bring two parts of my life together that I haven't been able to do before. I want to thank you all for coming tonight. I'm a little bemused, actually, because for the better part of my working on this issue, getting people out on a Wednesday night to hear about nuclear weapons was something that you had to do with a crowbar. And so to see people voluntarily turning out in numbers to think about nuclear weapons is somewhat gratifying to me, but also somewhat saddening, because I'm sorry for the ambient anxiety that I think so obviously contributes to people's interest in this topic. So I am grateful for you being here, and I hope that it'll be worth your time. I also just want to thank the members of my parish who are out in force, and it's lovely to see you all. So I'll see you all on Sunday. Two final caveats. I'm not a technical expert in nuclear weapons. I've spent my entire career in political advocacy and in scholarly and popular theology and ethics on the issue. So I'm not going to dwell on a lot of the technical components of nuclear weapons. I've been in the issue a long time, though, so if you have questions on that, I may be able to answer them in the Q&A period. If I can, I will. If I can't, I'll tell you that. The other is, you might be able to tell I have a cold. I've been studiously not talking to anybody all day, being very rude to everyone I could find, but I'm hoping my vocal cords give out, but I thank you for your patience. Finally, I just wanted to say I'm coming to this with two sets of dual identities. One is as a Canadian permanent resident and as an American citizen. So I vote. I don't live where I vote. And I don't vote where I live. And for me, this is going to be a bit of a cross-border talk in some sense, because my expertise and knowledge base is really the U.S. situation. But I am doing my best as a Canadian permanent resident, as the now father of two Canadian daughters. So I'm contributing, you know, 1/10 millionth to the population boom of Canada. To do my best to be responsible to my context as well. So I'll be navigating that as we go. The other dual identity, as you'll have gathered from the introduction, is that I'm an Anglican evangelical. And does everybody know what a mullet is, like in terms of the hairstyle, right? So the mullet, as hairstyles go, is what Anglican evangelicals are to the church. It's sort of business in the front and then party in the back. And that's kind of how this talk is going to go, I hope. So I'm going to start very respectably as an Anglican with you all, but by the end I might wind up being an evangelical, and I hope you'll bear with me. The outline of what we're going to talk about tonight is there on the screen in front of you. Three simple parts, which we'll just kind of dive into. One, what is happening? How we've arrived at our present anxiety and the crisis that it produces. Two, what to think, not telling you what to think, but what a distinctively Christian perspective might mean for considering nuclear weapons. And third, what to do, what a distinctively Christian witness would look like in action. And before I continue, can everybody hear me okay? I can hear myself just fine, but I'm self-conscious about my voice. All right. So what is happening? Let's see. Do I have my first slide here? Yeah. What is happening? A crisis of memory. I think we are engaged in a crisis of memory and remembering nuclear weapons at our present point in history. The fact is that the people who remember nuclear weapons being used are dying. They're getting old, and they are dying. I've been to Hiroshima and Nagasaki 3 times, and increasingly, the testimonials that you hear when you go are from adolescents at best, and getting down to children. And pretty soon, when you go to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there won't be anybody who lived through it who will be able to talk to you. And in that absence of lived memory, I think we're seeing similar other phenomena spring up. The renaissance of neo-Nazism and anti-Semitism is, I think, directly correlates to the fact that the horrors of World War II and the Holocaust are fading from lived memory. And so these horrors that lack a lived reality for people have started to become concepts that a new generation feels the liberty to kind of play around with. And I think we're seeing that with nuclear weapons as well. There's little sense among younger people exactly what these things do. Their grandparents maybe aren't around to tell them about them. So I think we are at a crisis point in the true sense of that word, danger and opportunity mixed. As many of you probably know, Donald Trump is traveling through Asia right now, President Trump, and I wonder, quite honestly, without a hint of scaremongering, whether historians will look back at this trip as dating the start of the Second Korean War. I have to say that I've been working on nuclear disarmament for 18 years. I have never expected the use of nuclear weapons as much as I do right now. I don't expect that they will be used as opposed to not be used, but if they are, I can't say that I will be surprised in this present moment. And I've never felt like that before, not in my entire adult career of working on this. The same crisis of memory, though, also presents some possibility to us, because they're not so sacrosanct anymore. They're not, you know, the weapons that won the great war, our grandparents' war. And so that offers a groundbreaking possibility for their elimination. And so the two pictures that are in the background here of this slide are Kim Jong-un watching a missile launch, and then the crew of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons celebrating their recent Nobel Prize win on the day that they found out. So I think it remains to be seen which way we're going to go. But the days of we must have them so that we don't use them are over. I think we either won't have them or we will use them. The macro sense of how we got here, of course, begins with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So the United States dropped 2 atomic weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th and August 9th, respectively, 1945. Those bombings resulted in over 200,000 dead. And the war wrapped up shortly thereafter. I think there is a mythology that they won the war. It's a mythology that I disagree with. I'd be happy to have that out in the Q&A period if you're interested. But nevertheless, regardless of historical causality, certainly there's that appearance, there's that sensibility, and I think that largely contributes to why we think of nuclear weapons as differently than we do about chemical or biological weapons. One won the war in the Pacific. The other two are the despicable arms of the Axis. There was subsequent proliferation. The USSR, the UK, France, and China. Over the next couple decades, there would be hundreds upon hundreds of atmospheric nuclear tests, which caused untold devastation, mostly to indigenous and rural populations in the countries that tested them. By the 1960s, and I'm going somewhere with this, by the 1960s, when China acquired nuclear weapons, there started to develop a concern that a world with dozens of nuclear-armed states would be troublesome. And so the countries got together and formed a treaty called the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty has been in force since 1970, and it is the cornerstone of the nuclear global nonproliferation regime. It is arguably creditable with why we don't have a world with dozens or scores of nuclear armed states. The central premise of the NPT, as I'll be calling it from now on, the central premise of the NPT was a grand bargain between the countries that at that point had nuclear weapons, the five permanent members of the Security Council, and everybody else. The nuclear haves agreed to pursue negotiations to the elimination of their own arsenals, and the nuclear have-nots agreed not to acquire nuclear weapons in the meanwhile. And everybody got access to nuclear power. That's the basic gist of the NPT. Now, granted, action on those disarmament movements did not start immediately in 1970. In fact, arsenals kept on ramping up. So let's see, I'm gonna skip ahead to this slide here. So you can see, this is just for background, you can kind of see the global stockpile of nuclear weapons, how it proceeded over the years. But you can certainly see that it doesn't stop going up at the time of the NPT, it actually starts to skyrocket. There's this massive increase in the Russian stockpile, or at that point, the Soviet stockpile. However, there were four nations that didn't sign the NPT. They were India, Israel, Pakistan, and Cuba. They, I think, rightly and presciently said, we are not going to consign ourselves to being second-hand states, and second-class states will be those that don't have nuclear weapons. They all subsequently developed their own nuclear weapons, except for Cuba, which has signed and joined the treaty. But the Democratic Republic of Korea, better known as North Korea, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, better known as North Korea, dropped out of the treaty in 2003 and has developed their own nuclear weapons. So there are four states that aren't party to the treaty, that aren't subject to its discipline, who have developed their own nuclear weapons. At the end of the Cold War, there was a terrific optimism, I think, that nuclear weapons were going to be a thing of the past, and a lot of the impetus for disarmament vanished from popular movements at that time. Some of you may have been part of the movements in the 80s or the 70s. And you would have seen the change in attitude that happened in the 90s, which from today's perspective look so remarkably carefree. The NPT was renewed indefinitely. It was originally a 25-year treaty in 1995. The states' parties got together and said, we think this is indefinitely good. We want to stay part of it. By the 2000s, there started to develop a global impatience, however, what I would describe as a global impatience, especially confronted with the international community's dissatisfaction with the George W. Bush administration and their nuclear posture. What had seemed like a temporary holding pattern in the NPT started to seem like a permanent discriminatory norm to a number of nations in the world. And they started to see it as a permanent situation of nuclear haves and nuclear have-nots. And it was arguably this situation that leads to North Korea pursuing their own nuclear program, as I said, in 2003. Now in 2008, this is a galloping tour of nuclear history, but please bear with me. In 2008, of course, Barack Obama is elected president of the United States, and in 2009, is the Palm Sunday of his first year in office. He gives a now famous speech in Prague, which says, "The United States seeks the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons, though possibly not in his lifetime." And it's arguably for this speech alone that he won the Nobel Peace Prize. That year. And his administration had some successes in this goal. They negotiated a New START treaty with Russia, a new strategic arms reduction treaty with Russia, which was middling in terms of its numbers, but it kept the numbers going down and kept inspection mechanisms back and forth. Toward the end of the second term, they negotiated a deal with Iran, which had every right to nuclear power, but the problem is that nuclear power and nuclear weapons use the same technologies. And so, depending on how states act, if you're developing nuclear power, it looks suspicious. It looks like you might be trying to create a nuclear weapons capacity. A lot of mistrust toward Iran leads to this landmark deal late in the Obama second term. But I would say, arguably, the Prague agenda was a disappointment, especially to those of us in the nuclear abolitionist sector. Who saw a great deal of rhetoric on the topic, but did not see a corresponding action. In fact, saw the nuclear status quo and the nuclear bureaucracy just completely undoing and ignoring the commander-in-chief's rather high-flown rhetoric. About the same time, in 2010, now here's the parallel strand, there is a shift, there's the development of what's called the humanitarian impact of nuclear weapons, HINW. This is a a focus of discourse around what the weapons do. So nuclear weapons conferences are always about how to keep them secure and who's going to use them when and how to keep them safe and that sort of thing. And this was an effort that just sort of said, we're not going to do that. We're not going to involve the security experts. It was largely convened by the International Federation of the Red Cross, which with the government of Norway convened a series of conferences that just asked, what do nuclear weapons do? What's the humanitarian consequence of these things? And they had three conferences in Norway, Mexico, and Austria, which were boycotted by the nuclear weapons states, which saw these developments as pretty dangerous. And that those subsequently turned into the negotiations for a ban on nuclear weapons, a universal ban on nuclear weapons. Similar has been done with landmines, chemical weapons, biological weapons. And that ban treaty was successfully negotiated at the United Nations and achieved on July 17th of this past year. It was a really remarkable history-turning accomplishment. It currently has 53 signatories. It has three ratifications. It hasn't been open for signatory or ratification very long. And once it achieves 50 ratifications, it'll enter into force. And that treaty is notable for focusing on the effect of nuclear weapons, especially in their testing, on women and children and indigenous communities, which have borne a disproportionate brunt of the consequence of nuclear testing. I think it's extraordinary because it deals with the cycles of reproduction and the way in which they are simply attacked by nuclear weapons and radiation. And I'm going to see how this works. So a couple weeks ago, I was in Washington at a dinner for the Plowshares Fund, on whose board I sit, and I had the privilege of sitting across the table from Beatrice Finn, who is the executive director of the organization that just won the Nobel Peace Prize. And I said, hey, I'm giving a talk in Toronto in a couple weeks. What would you like to say to everybody there? And so she said this.
Get angry and do something.
Could you hear that? She said, oh, that, my phone was all the way down.
Get angry and do something.
So there's the message of the Nobel Prize winner to you all, delivered personally. She said, get angry and do something, which is not far off from where I'm going to wind up.